KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, and indeed welcome back for another quarter of shows here on KZSU. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for tuning in today, and thanks for taking the time to listen on this hopefully what will be a sunny Wednesday afternoon. I'm very pleased today to have on Professor John Turanian of Chapman University School of Law, as well as a lawyer at Turner Green, Afrasevi, and Arledge in Newport Beach, California. We're going to have a pretty wide-ranging discussion, I think one that's slightly unusual for Hearsay Culture, in the sense that we're going to bifurcate the show kind of into two parts that are related. The first is a discussion of copyright law reform, which will segue in the latter part of the show into a discussion really about the practice of IP litigation broadly. John, who I will introduce by way of biography in a moment, but among other things, is a practicing attorney and has handled a number of cases in the IP realm, and cases ranging from issues regarding Winston Churchill to Britney Spears. For those of you who have memorized my biography, and I'm sure you have, but if you haven't, which I suspect are 99.99% of the people that listen, excluding my mother, you might remember that I practiced as well. Before going into academia, I was an associate at Pryor Cashman, Sherman & Flynn in New York, where I did a fair share of intellectual property and entertainment litigation as well. So we're going to have a discussion today where we take a look at these interrelated issues, first being copyright law and copyright reform, based upon an article that John wrote in the Utah Law Review last year entitled Infringement Nation, Copyright Reform, and the Law Norm Gap. And then the second half of the show is going to be a discussion of IP litigation. For those of you that listened to the show, you know that we often discuss the impact of intellectual property law on the legal system itself and how cases themselves are litigated. Earlier on in the show's history, we had Alan Morrison on, who was from and worked for various organizations, including Ralph Nader's Public Citizen, and we talked extensively about public interest litigation. And also, over time, I've had other litigators on and people who have litigated cases, from Mark Lemley, who litigates a lot of patent cases in front of the Supreme Court recently, and Jennifer Granick, who represents a number of white-collar cases in the criminal context involving hacking and other kinds of computer crimes. And so today I'm really excited to have a discussion with an IP litigator and someone that's handling a lot of very interesting cases right now. Obviously, before I do any introduction, I should note, and this will be evident to any lawyers out there, there is a certain limit to the discussion that certainly John can have with regard to active cases and cases that are ongoing. So I will not be doing the kind of probative interview that would require or ask John or demand John to violate an attorney-client privilege. As an attorney myself, I am quite respectful of that. So we will have a wide-ranging discussion subject, of course, to that limitation. John is an experienced intellectual property and entertainment attorney who, as I mentioned, has handled a variety of cases in the IP context. He's had a number of articles published in various law reviews, including the Yale Law Journal, UC Davis Law Review, Berkeley Technology Law Journal, and others. He is a tenured professor at Chapman University School of Law, and his background, he got his undergrad degree from Harvard University and his JD from Yale. The website for his law firm, Turner Green, has an extensive biography, including a list of clients, but I think for the interest of the listeners, representative clients include New Line Cinema, Josh Eagle is also known as Shag, X17, Western Digital, The Wall Street Reporter, Mammoth Equities, Zanku Chicken, Media Instruments Corp, Randall May International, Shiva Ray, and Jim Ulls, who was a screenwriter for Fight Club. And it clearly, as many litigators do, you often have a variety of cases, some of which many of which are entirely IP or entertainment related, and others which have elements of those. I also have that kind of background. And in fact, when I was at Pryor Cashman, I did a fair fair amount of work for New Line Cinema as well as other entertainment clients and people who and entities that are not in the entertainment industry. So, without any further introduction, if I've done my job properly, at the other end of the line is John Tarani. John, are you there?
I am. Thanks, Dave, for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today on Hearsay Culture. Let's dive right in. And as I mentioned in the beginning, your background, but perhaps I think for the benefit of the listeners, perhaps how you got into or why you're interested in IP law generally.
It was sort of an area which I came to as a fusion of a number of my interests. I'd always been very interested in technology issues. In fact, originally in undergrad, I was a physics major, and then people told me, hey, you're going to law school, you don't need a science degree, so I ended up becoming a government major, which is Harvard's fancy way of saying political science, but certainly the technology interest always remained, and I'm also always been captivated with the arts. And individuals with creative talents, partly because I'm so lacking in them. so it was a combination of an interest in the arts and technology with the law, that naturally led me to having an interest in intellectual property. And originally I started out mostly as a patent litigator, but gradually, got really interested in the more, art side and entertainment side of things. And so, my clients sort of transitioned into cases involving a lot of copyright issues and then more broadly entertainment litigation, which is where things stand right now. So really it's a fusion of my interests.
And, you know, it's funny, as you were saying that, I was thinking maybe we'll come back to this at the end of the show. I think for people that are listening or those that are listening that are contemplating or thinking about going into the entertainment law practice. I know for me that I was certainly interested in intellectual property, but a lot of it was just a matter of the opportunities that existed at the time that I was looking to go to law firms and that these opportunities were there. Perhaps towards the end of the show, we can touch very briefly on perhaps any suggestions you have for those people that are interested or thinking about going into entertainment law practice or IP law practice as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm happy to talk about that. I mean, the one immediate thought that comes to mind is, and this is something I tell students a lot who are interested in doing entertainment law. I mean, one of the funny things I found is all that stuff that that my parents said was a waste of time when I was a kid has actually turned out to be quite useful. You know, my knowledge of pop culture has been quite useful in terms of knowing what's going on in the entertainment industry. You know, all that time I spent reading gossip about celebrities has been invaluable in an odd way in terms of understanding the nature of numerous of my clients' businesses.
Yeah, it's very funny you say that. Yeah.
That, you know, some of that stuff that, you know, that you're passionate about, even if it, you know, people don't see it as translating into a career at the moment, oftentimes ends up affecting your career and in a very positive way.
You know, it's funny you say that because I had a similar experience where when I was a kid, my father would quiz me about actors that were in films that were made anywhere, you know, from the 30s to the 60s. And I always wondered, and I was never really criticized by my parents for watching movies. And I always wondered, you know, do I really need to know this? But you're absolutely right that actually that drilling, as it were, when I was a kid, actually did come in useful in practice. So
absolutely. I mean, you know, I was a big fan of modern art, when I was younger, and that's translated into having a number of art clients. You know, and again, nothing instrumental. It's just organically grown out of my own interests. Similarly, I'm a big fan of music, and that's translated also. You know, things that you don't think are going to translate career-wise, if you follow your interests and pursue what you're passionate about, it ends up coming back and benefiting you.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And of course, doing what you love is a key life skill anyway.
If you
have the fortune enough to be able to move in that direction. Well, let's start from kind of a top level, a little bit more macro level discussion of copyright law. As I mentioned in the introduction, your piece in the Utah Law Review in 2007, Infringement Nation, Copyright Reform and a Law Norm Gap. In your view, what is the core concern of copyright reformers?
You know, I think the basic issue that I raise in Infringement Nation is the idea that there is a disconnect between what the average American would see as just under copyright law and what the copyright law actually says, especially if enforced to the maximum extent permitted under the law. And the argument I make is basically that over time this disconnect has actually come to a fruition as litigation for copyright infringement has become more viable. The fact that it's all now taking place on the internet, so that there are digital footprints essentially that make searching out people easier to happen. I mean, certainly the recording industry's lawsuits against individuals who are engaging in peer-to-peer file sharing is an example. I mean, previously, unrecorded activity of that type was basically people swapping tapes, which is very hard to figure out who's doing it, when they're doing it, and there's not the surveillance technology. But peer-to-peer file sharing, obviously, is on a much more grand scale. But also, the other thing it does is it creates digital footprints. That allow the recording industry, if they're so inclined, to subpoena ISPs, internet service providers, and get information on who in fact is engaging in these activities, and to hunt them down and essentially bring the full force of the copyright law to bear against these individuals. And I think one of the concerns is the potentially draconian nature of the penalties that are being faced by potential copyright infringers, and also the fact that a lot of activity that is maybe not infringing is going to be suppressed because individuals simply can't afford to litigate a case all the way to trial to find out if what they're doing is in fact fair use or not.
Let's actually go to that latter issue first, because obviously it ties into our discussion here. And, there's a lot of discussion, and I know you're familiar with it, involving the chilling effect of cease and desist letters.
Absolutely.
And threats. What's your take on that? Do you think, is that a real phenomenon? And if so, what's your take on how the law deals with it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it is a real concern. I see it all the time with clients of mine who are on the receiving end of cease and desist letters. If they're wealthier clients, they can afford to ignore them and say, go for it, sue me. But if they're not wealthy, but they still believe what they do is soundly within fair use, they're probably going to back down. And one of the reasons is the cost of litigation is so high. I mean, if someone sues you, you've got to hire an attorney. The average cost of of taking a copyright case all the way to trial now, sort of the run-of-the-mill average copyright case, according to the American Intellectual Property Law Association, is about $500,000. Now, very few individuals can afford, or even many companies can't afford, to take a case to all the way to trial for $500,000. So faced with that prospect, a lot of times you're going to say, you know what, I back down. I'll pay the license fee.
Yep.
The problem with that, though, is sort of ex ante or ahead of time. People don't know what is fair use and what isn't fair use because it's a notoriously ambiguous doctrine. So almost everybody is going to err on the side of caution. And the side of caution means saying, I'll stop, I won't infringe, I won't use your work, or I'll pay the license fee. And that's a real problem because what it does is it essentially means if there's any colorable claim to infringement, individuals then have to pay up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that defeats sort of the meaning and the meat of the fair use doctrine. So it's a serious problem.
I want to discuss fair use shortly. But I think as a top-level discussion, getting into copyright reform, I think it might be useful to ask you this question. People are familiar with copyright litigation, but perhaps people aren't familiar with what it actually takes to actually litigate a copyright case. So maybe in broad strokes, when you say it costs $500,000 to litigate the average IP case, where is that money going? I mean, what kind of work
in general terms, of course, goes into it?
You've
got to get an attorney who's got to, catch up on what's been going on. If you're on the defense side, you're filing your answer, you're filing potentially a motion to dismiss to try to whittle down some of the claims. The big dollar bills start adding up when you go through the process of discovery, taking depositions, you know, plowing through documents which establish copyright ownership, or you know, make a, you know, shed light on the viability of a fair use claim. The, right there, you're looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then of course hiring experts to testify on issues related to the case. That's going to be expensive, and of course taking the case to trial is incredibly expensive. So that sort of that, those are all the costs that get rolled in. I mean, you know, attorneys obviously bill hundreds of dollars an hour, and a case rapidly becomes very expensive very quickly, such that what it does is essentially creates a chilling effect for individuals who really can't afford legal counsel or afford to fight. And I think that's unfortunate because, you know, one point that I make in my writing is that, you know, when we're talking about copyright, we're not just talking about property. We're talking about speech. And when you talk about chilling effects, you start talking about the First Amendment and the fact that individuals are out there engaging in potentially protected activity, artistic enterprises that may be using other people's copyrighted works, but for artistic purposes. And to the extent that they're being chilled from things that are likely fair use, that's unfortunate because it's not only sort of harming them individually, but it's also depriving the public of the creative works that might be brought to bear into the public realm if copyright law were more clear, or if the fair use doctrine was more clear, or if individuals could exercise their fair use rights without the threat of litigation.
The you know, the fair use is arguably the hottest topic in intellectual property law in terms of the public consciousness that is being dealt with now, and in the context of copyright reform. You know, of course, there's a wide-ranging debate, as you know, with those that think it isn't, the fair use doctrine itself isn't strong enough, and those that think that it's too much. I've had some interesting discussions, perhaps I'll get your take on, with entertainment industry attorneys who make really two arguments that I find interesting and with which I don't agree. Perhaps I'll get your reaction to the first argument with regard to fair use and particularly the licensing issues is that the real problem is the entities or people that are trying to use this stuff just don't have enough money in order to pay the licensing fee. So in other words, the issue is not a problem with the law, but rather the fact that the licensing fees themselves can't be met by the documentary filmmaker, for example, and therefore the problem isn't with the law, but with simply a resources-driven issue. The second point that is made is slightly more abstract in terms of the structure of copyright law, but the argument basically goes that fair use isn't a part of copyright law. Rather, fair use is a defense to copyright infringement. And I wonder if you think that that's a distinction with any meaning. So perhaps, you know, what are your reactions to those two arguments that I've heard, at least, from entertainment industry attorneys?
Sure. You know, and look, obviously, you know, I represent a lot of copyright owners who have copyright interests.
Sure.
And, you know, wearing my attorney's hat, I'm certainly sympathetic to the view of creators wanting to protect their product and manage its use in a way that makes sense and in a way that that properly compensates them for their creative endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly I'm sympathetic to that view. At the same time, I'm cautious about how far, you know, individual rights holders or corporate rights holders take those rights. And so let me address your two points. The first one, in terms of the problem not being with the law but sort of affordability, I mean, there are a few problems with that. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that the copyright laws that exist right now doesn't just, you know, give you the right to you know, to say that people, you know, I mean, well let me say, fundamentally it gives you the right to say absolutely no, you cannot use my work, period. And when you're facing someone who says that, it doesn't matter how much money in the world you have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an example that comes to mind is recently the litigation involving the Ben Stein movie.
Yep.
I can't quite remember the name. It was a documentary on creationism.
Right.
And I believe they were sued by Yoko Ono for their use of John Lennon's Imagine.
And actually, I'm going to jump.
They used the stanza involving his reference to a world without God.
Right. And just as by way of disclosure, that's a case, although I wasn't personally involved with it, where the Center for Internet Society actually represented the defendants in that case.
Right, exactly, and they prevailed.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, though, Yoko Ono said, what about my right to say no? What about my right to say absolutely not, you cannot use John Lennon's songs under any circumstances? Well, the problem with that is copyright law actually, if they had held the other way, would have given Yoko Ono the right to essentially have an injunction that would prevent anybody from using Lennon's works without Yoko Ono's permission. So there's not a matter of money. It's about this sort of absolute property or dominion that a copyright holder can potentially exercise over their intellectual property. So you don't, it's not necessarily a monetary problem. So, you know, essentially you could have people that hold out and say, I'm not going to do it under any circumstances. And one thing I've talked about in a couple of my pieces is looking at the possibility of moving to a regime where we don't give copyright holders that right anymore. In other words, we say, okay, you have the right to be fairly compensated for the use of your work, but you don't have the right to say no absolutely. And I think that might make a lot of sense because I think it opened up a lot of transformative uses. But that's not the way the law is right now. So I think that the fact that the law is not that way sort of rejects the first prong of the argument you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I also, you know, want to point out that one of the other problems is, and this is something that Congress and the Copyright Office has been working on recently, is the problem of orphan works,
yep.
Which is a lot of times you can't even track down the copyright holder.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of problems with chain of title with respect to copyrights. There's no really comprehensive database that shows who owns copyrights. So if you need to track down a permission to get from someone, let's say you're a documentary filmmaker and you're trying to use a piece of footage that was shot in the 1930s, which is potentially still copyrighted, good luck finding who the owner is.
Right.
And again, there it's not a problem of money. It's the problem of you're risking litigation because let's say you put that footage in your movie and someone sees it and says, I'm the rights holder. You're risking litigation and some severe penalties for not having cleared the rights ahead of time. But even if you made, you know, profound efforts, you may not have been able to find the rights holder.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's pending reform in the Copyright Office, you know, this is called the orphan works problem.
Right.
So that's sort of to address the first argument. The second argument with respect to fair use, I think is an interesting one. And I would say to those individuals who say, well, look, fair use is simply a defense to infringement, is, yeah, it is now. But when you look at the history of fair use and you look at the history of copyright law, you get a very different picture when you put it into historical context.
Mm-hmm.
So specifically, until the fair use doctrine was created, and it was created in a decision called Folsom v. Marsh, which was written by Justice Story in 1841, but prior to that time, our copyright laws were very, very different. Essentially, there was no fair use doctrine, which sounds bad, but actually in a lot of ways it was much better for users of copyrighted content. So I'll give you a specific example.
Mm-hmm.
In the old days, if you used someone's work and you made some new use out of it, in other words, made a transformative use out of it, your work was per se non-infringing.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have to proffer a fair use defense. Which is important because on a fair use defense, the burden is on the defendants to prove what they did as fair use. Whereas if a transformative use is per se non-infringing, the burden of proof is reversed. And so you tended to have a much more favorable system to defendants. Now, why is that necessarily a good thing? Well, it's not necessarily a good thing, but I'll give you an example of a couple of lines of cases where it was quite important.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a famous case involving Harriet Beecher Stowe, who, of course, wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. And back in the day, there was a very large German-speaking population in Pennsylvania. And someone had taken Harriet Beecher Stowe's work and translated it into German. Now, Harriet Beecher Stowe's husband was fluent in German, and he also had translated Harriet's work into German. And unfortunately, his translation wasn't quite as good as the allegedly pirated translation, which started selling very well. So Harriet naturally sued, claiming that they had infringed her work. The argument was simply one that would resonate in modern law, which is, look, you took my work, you translated it without my permission, that's a derivative work that's unauthorized, and it's sort of under modern law an open and shut case.
Mm-hmm.
They're infringing, Harriet Beecher Stowe would get an injunction, and that would be the end of things. Under the old understanding of copyright, the case actually turned out exactly the opposite. And if you look at the case, it's really remarkable. The court does this analysis and says, look, the pirated translation is selling much better than Harriet Beecher Stowe's authorized translation. Mm-hmm. And instead of saying, oh, woe is Harriet Beecher Stowe for this, the court says, this is a sign that the pirates have given us something good.
Hmm.
They've actually conferred a benefit to the public.
Interesting.
And doing a translation is no easy feat. It takes a lot of hard work, and they've done something that's of value, and we want to encourage value. And sort of they hearken back to the original language of the copyright clause in the Constitution, which talks about facilitating copyright in order to promote progress in the arts.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So based on that, they said, listen, Harriet has no property right to exclude individuals from doing translations. Anyone is. She has to compete in the translation market just like anyone else and let the best translation win. And so based on that, they said no infringement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, under the modern test, it wouldn't be per se non-infringing. You'd have to undergo the fair use factors. And the fair use factors, if you look at them, are actually four factors. I'm sure many in your audience are familiar with the four factors, but to summarize it, basically courts look at the purpose and character of a use, the nature of a copyrighted work, the amount and substantiality of the use, and the effect of the use on the potential market for the copyrighted work. Those four factors. If you think about those four factors, by and large, they focus not on what use you are making with the copyrighted work, but what you are taking from the author.
Hmm.
And so what's happened is with the advent of the fair use doctrine, its broad adoption by U.S. courts, and ultimately its adoption in the 1976 Copyright Act, the inquiry for courts when they're dealing with copyright issues is not what kind of use you're making, but more what are you taking from the author.
Hmm.
In the old days, the inquiry was what kind of use are you making? What are you giving to the public? And I think that inquiry was much more consistent with what the framers wanted, which is a utilitarian copyright, a copyright that was all about advancing the public interest broadly.
So let's actually pick this up, because it's an interesting point you're making, and segue and continue the discussion, really, which of course is merged with practice after the break. We're talking to John Turanian, professor of law at Chapman University School of Law, as well as an attorney at Turner Green, Alfred Sabian, Arledge. KZSU, for those of you that are listening to the show on KZSU, but really for anyone that listens to the show by podcast or iTunes or RSS feed or otherwise, is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires and really relies upon the donations of listeners to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to KZSU's website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. I do encourage you to consider making a donation to KZSU because, again, even if you're listening to Hearsay Culture by podcast, KZSU is the home of Hearsay Culture, and the support of KZSU allows the support meaning very clearly that the show is on KZSU, means, and the donation of resources and time, including Chizzy, the DJ that operates the board there, means that KZSU is the home of the show, and therefore making a donation to KZSU does support Hearsay Culture as well. So please consider that. We're back on Hearsay Culture with a discussion with Professor John Turanian. John, before that very short break, we were talking about fair use, and you did mention the issue of formalities and orphan works, and I'm curious to get your thoughts or your reaction to proposals, one of which was made by Chris Sprigman at UVA, to reintroduce formalities into copyright law. And I'll really allow you to explain what that means, but what's your view of having more formalities in terms of the registration of copyrights rather than less as based upon the more recent reforms of the Copyright Act?
Right. Ideologically, when you say more formality, I immediately shudder. But when talking about in the context of copyright law, I actually think I'm rather sympathetic to that view. And let me sort of explain what happened. Basically, with the passage of the 1976 Copyright Act, we went to a no formality regime, at least as far as copyright ownership is concerned. Basically, under the 1976 Act, the moment you create a copyrighted work or a creative work and fix it in a tangible medium, you own the copyright to it. It's done. You don't need to necessarily register. Now, you do have to register if you want to actually sue on it, but that's more of a procedural requirement. It does affect your revenues. But the result of that is something very important, which is in the world before the 1976 Copyright Act, a work was, as a default matter, not copyrighted until you registered it. Mm-hmm. Which meant that the vast majority of creative works made in the United States were not copyrighted, which meant the use of the vast majority of creative works was not copyright infringement. Post-1976, what happens is the second a work is created, it is copyrighted. That then means if you use anybody's copyrighted work, you are sort of, as a presumptive matter, infringing their work. And this is particularly dangerous, especially in sort of the internet era, where people are remixing and manipulating and digitally altering content on a constant basis, because we sort of have the power of the Gutenberg press at all of our laptops. And so what this does is it potentially opens up a minefield of copyright litigation, because as I argue, we're sort of all infringers in the digital age. That's one of the arguments I make in my article, Infringement Nation, where I do a sort of a hypothetical example of a day in the life of a hypothetical law professor named John, and I sort of follow his day and show all the things he does during the day, not one of which is P2P file sharing, and show that at the end of the day, if copyright owners were so inclined to enforce their rights to the maximum extent provided by law, John would be facing $12 million in liability, a figure that ends up leading him into the billions of dollars in damages over the course of a year, simply for unwitting conduct like swimming and showing off a tattoo he might have that's of a copyrighted character, to forwarding emails, to subscribing to a magazine that that publishes found letters that have previously been unpublished. So all those activities can expose you to liability.
Yeah, I think you came up with about 80 infringements.
I would make is that it might make sense to go back to a regime of some formality, because that'll shift us from this default rule of everything is infringing to a default rule of things aren't infringing unless they're valuable enough that the copyright work is valuable enough that someone has actually paid and gone through the necessary formalities to secure a registration. So I'm certainly sympathetic to that. I think it makes a lot of sense, especially in the internet era.
The focus that we have as we think about copyright law in our discussion really is it's the effects in litigation and being a practicing lawyer, and I do want to talk about that in more concrete terms. You know, in terms of the broad range of issues that you've handled in copyright, you've mentioned a few, but other than fair use, what do you see as the hot IP issues that are currently being litigated in your practice, and perhaps the incredibly unfair crystal ball question? What do you see coming down the road that's going to be litigated?
Well, I mean, one of the most significant issues that's being litigated right now involves the issue of secondary liability, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. It's basically a copyright doctrine that has expanded liability not just to direct infringers, but people who facilitate or encourage or materially contribute to the infringement of copyrights. And there are two theories. One which is called contributory liability, the other vicarious liability, and sort of a quasi-third theory that the Supreme Court announced in the Grokster decision involving P2P file sharing, which was the inducement theory of liability, which is perhaps a subspecies of contributory liability. In any case, this is very significant because with sort of the advent of Web 2.0, you have more user-generated content online. And of course, it's no secret that a lot of that user-generated content is in fact user infringed content. So, for example, YouTube is a quintessential example of users placing content on the YouTube website. A lot of that content is copyright protected and is uploaded without the permission of the copyright owner. The question is, Do the users face liability? Yeah, they probably do, so long as it's not fair use. But the broader question is, it's obviously difficult to go after the users. So copyright owners want to go after YouTube. The question is, does YouTube face liability? Now, under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, there is a safe harbor which allows YouTube to potentially avert liability if it conforms to certain takedown procedures upon receipt of a notification by a copyright holder. However, it is arguable that those provisions do not provide protection from the theory of vicarious liability. And there's the current pending case of Viacom versus YouTube, where they're making precisely that argument, that YouTube needs to share in the responsibility for the mass infringement that's occurring on its system and on its network. I mean, it's no accident that YouTube has generated its value and its wealth, certainly, right, it sold for several $1 billion. To Google recently, through essentially the content on its website, much of which is infringing content.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the big issues that's going to be litigated is the degree to which the DMCA does not protect vicarious copyright infringement, and the degree to which YouTube and other Web 2.0 sites are going to be exposed to copyright liability for the underlying infringing activity of their users.
What did you think of the Grokster decision?
I frankly found it a bit puzzling. I thought really the court essentially saw a problem for which existing doctrine had no solution for, and sort of out of thin air carved out this new inducement theory of liability, which I think has a lot of danger, because if it's not properly constrained, it can essentially subject all kinds of enterprises to liability for secondary infringement, simply for things like, one example that was given by another prominent copyright specialist is Apple used to have its logo as Rip, Mix, Burn, right? Now, arguably, that's inducing infringement. After all, Rip, Mix, Burn, that sounds like you're encouraging people to rip from CDs, which is arguably an infringing act.
Right.
And certainly under the Supreme Court's definition of what constitutes inducing infringement, Apple could be subjected to liability simply for an advertising campaign. So I think it's still a little early to see where the inducement theory is going to be taken. I mean, some people argue that literally it's very, very thin. It was basically carved out to apply to Grokster and other P2P file sharing. It won't be, applied anywhere else. But to the extent that it begins to be applied in other contexts, I think it can have a real stifling effect on technological development.
The entertainment industry is often vilified for positions it takes with respect to intellectual property. I think some of that vilification is warranted, but perhaps some isn't. I'm not going to attempt to what percentage is, at least for purposes of this discussion, nor will I ask you that question. But I will ask you this question, John. What's your take on the position broadly that the entertainment industry has taken with respect to users and their ability simply to copy a particular recording and put it on their iPod? There's been what I think is almost an absurd amount of attention to this issue, and I think a lot of it, in my view, has come from really very unclear statements that have come from the RIAA, and what at times appears in the public's eye to be a very, or perhaps too aggressive, litigation position of the entertainment industry. So rather than ask your opinion of what the entertainment industry is doing, I'm more curious to get your sense of what you think the entertainment industry can do or should do to deal with this new technology. As an IP attorney, what are your thoughts on that?
Right. One of the things is, certainly the music industry is sort of a cautionary tale in what not to do. I think, one of the most profound failings of the music industry is its reluctance to embrace digital technology. I mean, the fact of the matter is, Apple iTunes should have existed at least 5 years before it actually did.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it didn't was because the music industry essentially was saying, well, we don't want to put up our copyrighted content in digital format such that people will be able to rip it off. Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, for years they were ripping it off, and it was happening, and they weren't being compensated. What iTunes showed is, once people were given a viable means to actually legally purchase music at a reasonable price, they would do so instead of pirating. One, to conform with the law. Two, because the quality was better. Three, because it was less of a hassle. And you didn't face the risk of litigation. But iTunes should have existed years early, and frankly, I think partly the recording industry is hurting because now essentially the control of pricing in the recording industry is now being dictated from above by Apple, when frankly they should have had their own distribution mechanism online far earlier. So I think one, it shows the need to respond to consumers and provide reasonable ways for consumers to pay for copyrighted content that they want in a legal manner, and it shows that that when you provide that option, I'm not saying every user is going to take it up, but a significant number will, and that enables you both to profit and also head off the tide of piracy. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other real problems has been the inconsistency, as you said, of the of some elements of the entertainment industry, and perhaps the sort of extreme stances they've taken. You know, I'm reminded of a recent story involving the recording industry convincing the Boy Scouts of America LA branch to create a new merit badge for copyright law. And students, Boy Scouts were encouraged to learn about copyright law. And it was fascinating when you looked at the program that was designed for copyright law, there was not a single mention of fair use. And that's instructive because what you essentially have is the recording industry not presenting a balanced view of what the law is. And I think there's plenty in the law to like for the recording industry, so why not present a balanced view? Acknowledge that there is fair use. Acknowledge that certain uses are going to be okay. For example, taking the CD that you've purchased and engaging in place shifting by placing it on your iPod should legitimately be seen as personal, non-commercial fair use. Mm-hmm. But to the extent the recording industry is resisting even that, it's just further antagonizing its own consumers and sort of losing them in the process.
The general confusion among the public, I think, it still exists with regard to what is really copyright protected and what isn't. And I think that's also something that hopefully my program in a small way can help, but really just educating the public about what copyright law is, I think can go a long way to solving the entertainment industry's perceived problems. And I'm curious to get your sense of that. I mean, as you litigate these cases, and you have your discussions with your clients. Obviously, your clients are many of them are sophisticated entities that live and die by IP rights. But from a broader perspective, when you discuss these things, what's your sense, if you have one, of the general public's understanding of copyright and what it means?
Well, I think A, there are a lot of misconceptions about what is copyrightable, what isn't, what fair use is. So I think there is a heavy need for education. But one of the things I think we've seen over the last decade is a tremendous rise in consciousness about copyright law.
Right, it's something you talk about in your article.
I think it's really been driven by two facts. First, our daily interaction with copyrighted content has increased dramatically. I mean, the fact is we all consume copyrighted content, and we all create copyrighted content on a daily basis. And this is made all the more true by the fact that we now sort of live in a world where we're wired to the Internet. And so, hence, we're constantly manipulating, downloading, digitizing, altering copyrighted content, and creating our own copyrighted content in the form of blogs, in the form of radio shows, in the form of Flickr photo books or MySpace pages, which include copyrighted content, all of that. So I think people are understanding that copyright law is much more of direct relevance to them. I mean, when you go back, you know, a generation ago, very few people thought about copyright law. It was sort of, you look at the debates of the 1976 Copyright Act, and it was basically the work of a few special interest groups that had significant interest in copyright and not much else. You know, if you look at the mainstream press over the last few years in sort of the educated, media, you see increasing articles about copyright law and its relevance, more attention paid to changes in copyright law. And so you really have seen a vast increase in copyright consciousness. And I think this is only a good thing because, A, it allows people to understand more about what the law is, but it sort of broadens the debate about what the law maybe should be and what potential directions it's going to take. And this is important because the last wholesale revision to the Copyright Act was in 1976. And if you think about what the world looked like in 1976, especially vis-a-vis copyright, it was a very different world. It was a world essentially before the modern Internet, before the World Wide Web. And so there are a lot of questions about the applicability and viability of our laws to sort of the exigencies of the digital era. And so to the extent that we get the public involved in copyright and educated about copyright, I think we can get a broader dialogue about copyright going that incorporates broad interests into what future legislation there is.
In your LawReview article you were discussing previously, in fact, you talk about the work made for Hire Amendment and how that, in fact, was repealed and the change that existed. For the benefit of listeners who may not be familiar with what a work made for hire is, what is it and what's the significance of that story?
Sure. There's a doctrine in copyright law called work made for hire. I mean, the default rule in copyright law is that if you create a work, you are the owner of the copyright owner of that work. That's the default rule. The big exception to that is a work made for hire, and there are two ways to have a work made for hire. The first way is if you're an employee and in sort of the scope of your employment, you create a work. If that's the case, then the work is owned, the copyright is owned by your employer. The second way is if you have a specially commissioned work in writing and it falls into one of, I believe, 9 categories under the Copyright Act. Now, this is important because, for the example, let's say you're a member of the recording industry, a recording artist, a musician, and you record a song for your record label. Well, you're not an employee of that record label. So the only way that work is a work made for hire is under the second prong of the work made for hire doctrine, which is a specially commissioned work. However, quite notably, the list of categories of what can constitute a work made for hire does not include sound recordings. So there's ambiguity as to whether a sound recording can ever, in fact, be a work made for hire. Now, this is a big issue because although every standard recording contract says this work is a work made for hire, and even if it isn't, you transfer all the copyright to us, it makes a big difference because, number one, works made for hire have a sort of different copyright duration than regular works. And number two, if a work is not a work made for hire, a recording artist possesses what's called a termination right, which is essentially 35 years after you transfer your copyright, you can get it back. And this is a very interesting and sort of unusual provision of our copyright law that's meant to protect, for example, the starving artist who early on in his or her career may transfer the copyright to a song for a buck and then 35 years later figure out that he's the Beatles and realize that the recording's worth a lot more. This very unusual provision allows you to terminate the transfer copyright and it goes back to the owner of the copyright or his or her heirs. And this is going to be a big, profound issue in the coming years as more and more recording artists try to terminate their copyright and get back the rights to their music. Aware of this, the recording industry was quite concerned and passed an amendment to the Work Made for Hire doctrine a few years ago, sort of in the dead of night through Congress, that explicitly amended the Copyright Act to say that sound recordings were works made for hire. But immediately thereafter, there was a vast public backlash and a backlash from musicians, and in a sort of extraordinary step, Congress actually repealed the amendment. So right now, it's ambiguous still as to whether sound recordings do count as works made for hire, but I think what's important about that example is right there you had, I think, a real sea change in sort of public reaction to copyright law. And in past years, copyright changes were made all the time, and there was very little public resistance simply because people weren't aware of what was going on in copyright law and weren't concerned about its implication on their daily lives. But the work made for hire doctrine change was a sort of a remarkable moment where you had massive public interest lobbying going the other way and, in fact, engaging Congress to take sort of the unprecedented step of repealing an amendment. And I think what it does is it signifies that going forward there's going to be a lot more resistance to changes that are perceived to come from special interest groups in copyright law. And I think one of the things that triggered this was, of course, the Copyright Term Extension Act in 1998, which has been derisively known as the Mickey Mouse Copyright Term Extension Act.
Right.
From people, what it did essentially extended the copyright term by 20 years, and there was a Supreme Court case that ultimately held that it was a constitutional exercise of Congress's power. But you've had a lot of individuals rally against this seemingly unprecedented increase in copyright duration, arguing that copyright terms are now getting to the point where they're virtually infinite. I mean, currently, if you're an individual and you create a copyrighted work, you have a term of life plus 70 years, which is a long time and a far cry from the original Copyright Act in 1790, which gave you a term of 14 years of copyright protection. And so the question is, or the concern is, that we're basically eviscerating the meaning of the public domain. There's nothing in the public domain anymore. And you have groups like the Creative Commons and certainly Stanford's efforts and the efforts of other institutions to sort of promote public domain, promote the common public interest, and get these issues of copyright ownership, copyright duration out to the public. And I think that's an important step.
We have about 3 minutes left talking with John Tarani, and a professor of law at Chapman University School of Law. John, in 3 minutes, this is I always enjoy asking questions like this at the end of the show, because I try to avoid asking questions that take a while. So I'm going to ask you this in a way that hopefully you can answer in about 3 minutes. So it almost sounds like an exam question, but I guess it is. So I'll ask you this. So, you know, you have your clients, you know, some of them have longstanding IP policies, and really, although all companies these days should have an IP policy and an IP strategy, many don't. So, based upon your experience, there's no average company, but for a new client coming in thinking about the issues that as a company they should think about with respect to copyright, what would be your advice generally, or in broad strokes, and again, in now about 2 minutes and 40 seconds,
right,
regarding a copyright strategy?
A lot of companies, their most valuable asset is their intellectual property, specifically their copyrights. I mean, that, depending on the industry, also their trademarks and or their patents also. But I would tell them that, look, it is your most valuable asset, and in order to protect it, you need effective counsel. Again, these are broad strokes, so I can't, every company is different, but there are a lot of issues that, that are very technical, that need to be parsed through very carefully. And one thing I see in sort of the general practice of law is a lot of people end up hitting copyright issues in their practices when they don't have a ton of copyright experience. And this can be treacherous, because the Copyright Act is full of minutiae, full of wrinkles. And I think you need really effective counsel with a background experience in copyright to make sure that you protect your copyright to the maximum extent. And that includes making sure that assignment and work-for-hire agreements are fully in place, making sure that you properly register your copyright so that you have a plan of action should they be infringed, so that you can sort of seek maximum penalties under the law that are available if you're a copyright owner. All of those are important strategic issues that need to be thought of ahead of time, really in the early stages of a company's development. Another issue is also forming a holding company for your intellectual property, which has several advantages. I won't go into them now, but that's an important issue to consider doing.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the registration, ownership, licensing agreements, having those all in place to maximally protect your copyright is vitally important, because in many cases it's the most important asset as a company you have, especially if you're in the content creation industry or the entertainment industry.
John, as a last question, I know that you wear a variety of hats, and not just IP litigator and IP scholar, but I also know that you have a book forthcoming.
Yes.
This is even more ridiculous question than the last one. Yes. In about 20 seconds or so, what's the name of the book, and what's it about?
Thanks. Well, the book is coming out with New York University Press in December. It's already available on Amazon.com. It's called Whitewashed, America's Invisible Middle Eastern Minority. And it's an area of research I've done on the side, which is on law and race and the construction of racial identity and our notions of whiteness. It's totally off the beaten path from copyright and intellectual property, but basically presents an analysis of American race law, our construction of whiteness, and the particular paradox of Middle Eastern Americans who are deemed white by law due to some decisions back in the early part of the 20th century involving race. but on the other hand are treated as something less than white, sort of in daily life on the street, and especially post 9/11, where Middle Eastern Americans have been experiencing a lot of discrimination as sort of part of the collateral damage on the war on terrorism. So it addresses sort of the balancing of our civil liberties with the very important need to fight terrorism, and also looks at the particular issues facing Middle Eastern Americans, and then more broadly issues of race that have been involved in our society, you know, since sort of day one of the Republic, especially, you know, the black-white divide and even beyond that. So notions of racial construction and all that. So, yeah, I'm excited. I think it's an interesting book, and, it comes out December at the end of the year, and it's available for pre-order on Amazon or any other bookstore site.
John, it sounds like a fascinating book, and I look forward to reading it. It unfortunately, I'm not sure that it neatly fits into the hearsay culture topic formats. However, if there is a way, I would certainly have you on to discuss it, and certainly invite you back to have a discussion. John Taranian, a professor of law at the Chapman University School of Law, and attorney at Turner Green, Alfred Seavey, and Arledge. Thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Hey, my pleasure, Dave. Thanks so much.
We've been talking to John Taranian, and you know, his work is work that I admire, and I always enjoy reading his articles and look forward to his books. Aside from writing in a very accessible way, I think he's also a colorful writer, and so I encourage even those that are not IP lawyers to seek out his articles. I'm really excited about upcoming guests for the quarter. I have a number of authors coming on, including Clay Shirky, author of Here Comes Everybody, Professor Michael Moyer from Boston University, author of Patent Failure, as well as Morley Winograd and Michael Hayes, authors of Millennial Makeover. I'll also be having on later in the quarter Professor Paul Ohm from University of Colorado Boulder, discussing his views in the world of cyber law, as well as several other law professors. And down the road, going into the fall, people like Neil Netinol and others, Neil's written Copyright Paradox, and Ned Snow from the University of Arkansas, Michelle Bowens, president of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, and many other guests that I'm working on booking. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedbacks, thoughts. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. The show is available not only through KZSU Live, but also through hearsayculture.com, as well as the iTunes page for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you so much for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.